I don't know what really prompted me to even consider it, because I've been perfectly happy in this retirement period. You know, a little bit bored from time to time, but a challenge like this was hard to turn down.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFerlin.
Hello.
In the middle of the spring international break. Yeah, the clocks are gone forward. The evenings are lighter. Really are getting into the business end of the season. But for club football, you've still got to wait quite a bit of time to see some action. Jan, when does Sunderland play next?
We're next playing on Sunday, the 12th of April.
And as we're talking, it's still March. We record on
it
Monday.
It's still
evening.
March.
It's 30th of March. They haven't played last weekend, and they're not playing again until, yeah, mid-April. Wow. You miss the whole of Easter, don't you?
Exactly. And Easter used to be a football fest, isn't it? Only second after Christmas.
But it's not this season, because it's FA Cup quarterfinals this week. So you've got to wait another week after that. Then who do you play on your return, after so long out of the game? You'll be a bit ring rusty, I'm sure.
We've got a nice easy game against relegation candidates Tottenham Hotspur.
Ooh.
Who will be on their new manager bounce.
Yes. Yeah, listeners, in case you've been living under a rock for the last couple of days, Tottenham have decided to part company with Igor Tudor. Obviously wasn't the easiest time for the Croatian. And now they're on the lookout for someone else. Terry, were you in any way surprised to see that Tudor left?
Not really, no. I mean, given the run of games that they had, I mean, like 44 days, zero wins, one draw, one win in the Champions League, but as a second leg against L'Atleti. So does that count as even an actual? I mean, yes, it does, but does it not in this context, it doesn't. It doesn't mean anything, does it, really? And they've been a disorganised rabble. I remember watching the game against Liverpool. And they seemed to be in a little bit better shape, and they managed to salvage and rescue a point because Richarlison likes to score against Liverpool. And even this Tottenham side were not in a position to deny him that. And you did think to yourself, well, okay, but the trouble is it's Liverpool, and we all know how Liverpool can descend into rabbleness themselves and have done this season. So you couldn't judge much with that. And in fact, it just got progressively worse. The last league game, the game against Forest, which Graham and I discussed last week, we won't go too much into, but yeah, I mean, like, how not to play a six-pointer. Absolutely textbook example of how not to play a six-pointer. It is worth pointing out that Igor Tudor's father passed away as well. So I can imagine that the two are not unrelated. I mean, obviously, yes, doing terribly, but this can't be the right moment to be trying to take on this kind of job. So it is actually quite sad for Igor Tudor, because I mean, he must have probably seen this as being his big breakthrough, a opportunity to establish himself as a name and a potential firefighter in the Premier League. Yeah, I think it will be a while before we see him back in England again.
Jan, what must Tottenham fans be feeling at the moment? Do you think they're feeling relief that Tudor's gone? Because it has not been good. As Terry said, the only game they won was a second leg that they were already pretty much already out of the competition. So are they feeling that maybe if you get someone new in, as long as it's the right guy, obviously, there will be a change. There will be a new manager bounce, which they obviously didn't get under Tudor, because he lost, what, five games in a row in charge of them.
It was funny watching the meltdown, obviously, of Spurs, which we've covered across this season. It's been probably the biggest highlight of this season. But if you're a Spurs fan, I think it's fair to say that the majority of Spurs fans were after Thomas Frank's head for some time leading up to his departure, which I think was probably a little late. And then to bring in Igor Tudor was seen as a bit of a turning point. The board had actually listened. They've got someone in who's got a tough reputation. And as you said, he came in wanting to kind of brand himself as someone who could save them and then hopefully crack on from there and achieve nothing. we were all chatting on our little group during the Atletico Madrid game during that first 15 minutes, which was just, I mean, putting on Kinski as the goalkeeper who'd done two League Cup games before that this season, and just to watch that meltdown in the first 15 minutes and not go and console his player when he substituted him shortly afterwards. I mean, any football fan watching that, but certainly if you're a Spurs fan watching that, you'd be like, what's going to happen? What is going on? Sorry. And you even said, Graham, he'll go for this. And I think had it not been for the passing of his father, I think he probably would have gone a lot sooner than he actually did. So the favourite is Roberto De Zerbi, who's been out of work since he left Marseille in February. It surprises me that this is apparently a done deal now and that he's going to come in before the end of the season. This is what we're hearing at the time of us recording. But they must be giving him a fair whack. There's talk of a 5-year contract there, which he can't really lose on. But for him to have, I mean, he's got fairly good stock, I would say. You know, he's got everything to lose there on his reputation going to Spurs. And if he doesn't get it to turn around in 7 games, then he's got that on his CV that he took Spurs down. Albeit with an asterisk that it wasn't his team and he was brought in for a specific role. But that seems like a strange one for me. Maybe it would have been the right thing to do 5 games ago instead of Tudor bringing in De Zerbi. But it does seem like a bit of a head-scratcher to me, bringing him in at this stage. So going into the guise of a Spurs fan, I'd be as flabbergasted by this appointment as I would have been by Tudor.
It is a question of, right, okay, you've called the firefighter, but it's still all burning down in front of you. So who else do you call? Terry, De Zerbi, he's got Premier League experience, but he's got Premier League experience at a well-run club. That said, he has got experience at Marseille, and Marseille are an absolute bin fire of a club. And he's done all right there. All right, in Ligue 1. And even a clown car club like Marseille can do well in Ligue 1. But it strikes me that he was holding out to say, yeah, I'll take the Tottenham job next season when someone else has kept them up in the Premier League. Then I'll come in over the summer. And now another truck full of NFL hosting cash has pulled up outside of his house and convinced him that he might want to take this on, as Jan just pointed out, in this perilous stage at the end of the season and for, well, the next 5 years as he tries to get them out of the Championship again.
It's just take a moment to salute your persistent references to NFL and Tottenham Hotspur, which I admire this. I admire this level of pettiness from you, Graham. It's what we like to see. I mean, obviously, he was fired from Marseille for not doing a very good job. I mean, he wasn't stellar last. I mean, he lost 10 games last season. And I have to say that if you're Marseille, you should be coming in firmly, albeit probably at a distance, but firmly behind PSG. And you need to be getting your loss column down to single figures, I think, if you're the Marseille manager. So I'd say it was a qualified success there. He didn't do badly, let's say that. And that seems to be enough for Tottenham. You're right to say that Marseille are a binfire club, but they have always been a binfire club and they have always kind of made it work. You know, I mean, Tottenham is not Marseille. They are different places. And I think a lot of the reason why Marseille are the way they are is because of the character of the city and its people and its fans. I think it's a different kind of dynamic. I'm sure Marseille could be run better, but it will always be run chaotically. That's just how it is. Whereas Tottenham, on the other hand, you think could really be run better. So I think it's a different kind of chaos that he's coming into, and I'm not altogether certain that he's demonstrated the credentials to do that. I mean, you're right. He was very good at Brighton, I'd say. I'd have to say he was very good at Brighton. He got them to Europe, he got them into the Europa League, he got them close to an FA Cup final. He did well there. But again, it's very, again, the asterisks have to be out there for Brighton as well, because this is a very well-run football club. And there's an argument to say that any reasonably competent coach could go in there and do a reasonably good job there. Tottenham, on the other hand, is a bin fire and requires a great deal of regeneration and reconstruction. And I mean, is De Zerbi the guy to do that? I'm just a little bit surprised that, given the aforementioned NFL cash, given the club's, it doesn't work when I say it, does it really? It doesn't have that bite. There's no edge to it, is there really? Given the amount of money there, given the size of the stadium, given the sheer potential, De Zerbi does feel like a kind of C-list manager. I wouldn't have thought them going for an A-list manager because it, you know, there's too much work to be done and the big top draw managers have got more to do. But if they were looking at this guy for the summertime, when there were other coaches coming on stream, I mean, Glasner being one of them, Iraola being another one, are we now at a point now where Tottenham can't really realistically attract those guys? And that tells you something as well, doesn't it? So it is a period of uncertainty. And yeah, of course, there's every likelihood that Tottenham will be a championship club by that point, in which case it's completely irrelevant. So is that what's going on here? Is there a feeling, look, we want De Zerbi to come in the hope that he can give us the two wins that Tottenham probably just about need to get themselves out of this situation? But if he doesn't, then we need a coach who is willing to manage in the championship as well. Because that's what's going to happen if he doesn't do it. And it needs to be the same coach. And then, of course, is De Zerbi a championship coach? Never managed in that division. That is not a division to be taken lightly.
Benitez did it, didn't he?
Yes, he did. With and Benitez, but Benitez was pretty much everywhere he went up until a certain point in his career. Benitez, everywhere he went, did something. It's only towards the back end of his career where he was running out of good options.
Yeah.
The Everton move was a disaster and he went to Vigo, didn't he? And that didn't work out.
Silva's managed in the championship and he's available in the summer.
Yeah, but we're now at a point where these guys, they're probably looking for top four, top six clubs.
Yeah,
they're waiting for a Champions League club to come on stream. Or, and this may make you laugh, but there are now reports, it may be complete nonsense, but there are reports that Crystal Palace, for example, are putting together a package for Iraola.
Yeah.
Which, you know, tells you something. I mean, I don't know whether that would happen, but it tells you something about the way things are right now. That, you know, 5 years ago, that would have been, well, 2 years ago, that would have been nonsense. Not just because Crystal Palace being where they are, but also because of Tottenham where they are. The idea of Tottenham, it's like, why aren't Tottenham going for that coach? He would be an excellent coach for any football club. But is it because they maybe put the feelers out to their agents and said, oh, well, you know, what's the feeling on us, you know, for when he comes to the summertime, Iraola, Glasner, you know, Silva. Is there any interest on their side? And maybe their agent's saying, well, actually, mate, thanks, but no thanks.
If the worst does happen to Tottenham and they get relegated, I mean, it's a really good point about the market that they're in now in terms of the managers that they can attract. So we saw when Sunderland got relegated and went on that terrible run down the divisions. Once you're out of the Premier League, like you're in a completely different marketplace then. No one's going to look at you and go, well, it's a big club. Tottenham are a massive club. But in the Championship, when you've had two really bad seasons, okay, they won a trophy in Europe, but really, I mean, that was the only highlight in an awful season, wasn't it? This season's been god-awful, and if it gets them relegated, you know, is there an A-lister that's going to take that on? And there's not. No one's going to go down to the Championship if you've got an offer from another big club across Europe. This is a potential recipe for disaster because De Zerbi, when he took over at Brighton, as you said, a very well-run club. He took over from Graham Potter as well. So that was a stable squad of happy individuals, despite what Terry might say about him. I think he left it in good order. And he shone there. He did very, very well. But he did lose his first five or six games. And that's something that's followed him around across his career. So if you're looking for somebody to come in and he's got to get something out of these seven games, the players he's going to inherit are broken. They're shattered. They've seen, three? This will be the third manager this season. Have I got that right? Three? Yeah. They've fallen out with both of the previous two, certainly the first one. There's, you know, interpersonal relationships that are falling apart amongst the squad. And to bring in someone who has been suggested he's quite volatile into that situation, and he's got a track record of taking time to turn things around or to get them playing that he want, where he wants. Spurs do not have that. They do not have that luxury. And when he was at Marseille, I think there was a defeat they had, and he accused the players of embarrassing him and refused to coach them for a couple of weeks, which obviously led to his exit. So he takes over Spurs. Let's look at a scenario. He takes over Spurs. They get the new manager bounce and beat Sunderland. That's clearly what's going to happen. Okay, in my mind, that's what's going to happen. We all know that. Then the bounce is gone and he gets embarrassed. Three games on the bounce. And then Spurs are in the bottom three. What happens then? What happens to a man who sometimes can't hold it together with the players, that can be volatile, with a lot of pressure on him around the ground, people booing him, and the directors of the club just kind of shaking their head going, we've got this wrong three times in a season now. that's a powder keg, which will be hugely enjoyable to watch. Just let me caveat that. It will be amazing to watch that happen. But I'm saying that not just because it's going to be really great, but also because it seems like another bad appointment.
Yeah.
But great TV.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even if he goes, even if he's only here till the end of the season, which it could happen if it goes disastrously wrong and everything is in place for it to go disastrously wrong. As Terry says, he may only need two wins and he may get those, but it could go disastrously. And as well, the fans are already pissed off. And there is a section of fans that don't want him there anyway. There's a section of fans that don't like the fact that he defended Mason Greenwood and played Mason Greenwood repeatedly. And so he's got that to contend with as well. He's got to try and win them over somehow. I just don't see it happening. I think this is yet another poor appointment. Now it's coming up to years and years of poor appointments.
If you look at it from the point of view of the club, they're in a bit of a rock and a hard place, aren't they, really? Because, I mean, like, they are at a point now where they probably can't find an interim coach at this point, because any interim coach coming in there of any quality is going to go, wow, this is too late. I'm just going to end up ruining my reputation, or my reputation taking. I want to come in and improve players, and like, there's not enough time to do anything here. There's no Ryan Mason really to step in. Well, there is actually. There is the actual Ryan Mason. But beyond that, there's no coach who can necessarily step in and look after things. There's no guarantees about what the future holds whatsoever. And so, yeah, they are now restricted, I think, to a degree, to what manager they can hire. And De Zerbi, in his plus column, has plenty of experience managing in the Premier League, has a familiarity with the league. But yeah, you're right, Graham. I mean, there's this whole business with his position on Mason Greenwood and how that goes down with a section of the fans. We don't really know how large a section that is and what that looks like in a natural match day experience. But you want to be going into a situation like this with an absolutely clean slate. And if you don't have that from day one, oh yeah, then you're in a lot of trouble. And yeah, let's say they lose every game from now under De Zerbi from now, or pick up a couple of points and still get relegated. I mean, like, is that really the best foundation to then go on and launch a championship winning campaign? What if they lose the first four games of the championship season or only pick up a couple of points? That is a perfectly reasonable thing that could happen in the championship. Even for a club as resourced as Tottenham, it is a long way down.
Yeah.
It may, on the table, it doesn't look very long, but for Tottenham, it is a long way to fall. And they're going to struggle in the championship at first. That doesn't mean there's plenty. The great thing about championship is a ridiculously long season, loads and loads of games, plenty of opportunity for you to get on a run and go and bounce back up. But it'll be fraught and perilous and unpleasant and undignified. What the hell kind of coach wants to do that kind of job? How desperate is De Zerbi to get back into management?
I'll tell you the coach who will do that job for them, Scott Parker. They will have to drive a big truckload of money up to Burnley and say, can we have Scott Parker for our season in the championship? Because he's the only guy I can see who can get them out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is absolutely the right guy for the job. But that's another reason why De Zerbi is a compromise appointment, because to say, let's wait for Scott Parker is to admit defeat. Is to admit defeat. But that is the guy you have to wait
that
for.
Is.
You have to say, well, look, we've got two guys. We've got Premier League guy and we've got Championship guy. Our Championship guy is Scott Parker. And yep. We will prepare the truckload of cash and then just put in the postcode at either of Scott Parker's address or the other guy, whoever it is. And then just go.
Well, of course, there was one guy they did miss out on. I was scrolling through the football news last week and I stopped in my tracks when I saw the news of someone who has returned to management in the championship. And of course, it's someone very close to our heart on the podcast, Roy Hodgson. Roy Hodgson has, at the age of 78, has taken another job. In his 50th year in football management, he has taken yet another job, this time at Bristol City, returning to Bristol City after 44 years away from the club. Yes, he last managed them in 1982. Great to have him back, isn't it, Terry?
Is it, Graham? Is it? 78? I can only assume that he knows what he's doing. It's just that he The reason why he left when he did was because he fell ill in training and he had to be taken to hospital. And it was awful. And for a moment, I think people were thinking the worst. I think if we're being truthful, Palace took that as the opportunity to let him go. And Glasner was happy to come in and turn things around. I don't know. Am I being ageist? I guess I probably am being ageist. I think I am being ageist. It's great to have him back. And there's no reason why he can't do a job at Bristol City. It's only for a few weeks. I assume the remit is to turn around the losing streak and try and get the club maybe back up as close to the playoffs as possible, if not into the playoffs, and try and rescue the season. Because Bristol City have been knocking on the door of promotion for a while now, and they must be getting a little bit fed up of not making it through. It's been a while since he's managed in the Championship. But he only has a handful of games, and he has demonstrated in the past that he can do a job in a relatively short space of time. My only concerns is sort of like his ill-fated spell at Watford recently that makes me worry about that. But I don't know. It's a different club. And I think the problem with City is that they've got the players. It's just for some reason they just stopped listening to the coach, I guess.
Yeah, Gerhard Struber won just one out of the last 9 games, and I think a change was imminent, wasn't it, anyway? And you say 7 games left of the season. I think insurance must be phenomenally high for that appointment, though. But it's a little risk. They are 12 points above the relegation line. They are 12 points off the playoff line as well. So minimal risk there, but yeah, they certainly want to get things going in the right direction there. Jan, is Terry being ageist there, do you think? Or does Roy really deserve to enjoy his retirement at some point?
I don't think he's been ageist. I think it's just a genuine concern for somebody who should be putting his feet up. And I'm talking about Roy here rather than Terry. But no, he is 79 in August. I just read on his wiki page.
Yeah.
He should be putting up his feet and growing tomatoes. Instead, his wife is probably saying, can you get out of the house and go and find something to do? You're under my feet. Go to the West Country. So that's where he's gone. Oh, good luck to him. He's been a big force in football for decades and decades now. And he's well-liked. He's had some ups and he's had some downs, and hopefully this will be a last hurrah for him, and then he can go and enjoy his retirement.
Yes, yeah.
We know guys like Roy. He reeks of, I can't just sit here, I'm bored, and he doesn't know what else to do. The guy doesn't have any hobbies, and probably it is a case of, I can't just sit here and just like listen to the missus. All love and respect to Mrs. Hodgson, absolutely, but it feels like this is a kind of, I just need to go back to work. It tells you something about the man, doesn't it, really? Because clearly football is just must be this guy's life. You know, for him to reach that point where most people, even people, think about Jurgen Klopp, who talks, I know he talks occasionally about going back into management, but he strikes me as being the kind of guy who's thinking, I want to have a nice, long, fulfilling life. I'm just not necessarily ready to retire yet. But he is a guy going, yeah, I have retirement plans. Okay, yeah, I have my Schloss ready and waiting for me. I think that Roy Hodgson has never ever thought about what he's never kitted out his potting shed, but there's no Hodgson allotment, is there? It just feels as though he's just a guy who just cannot retire. He can't get football out of his system. And you've got to respect that about a guy after 50 years of coaching players and he still hasn't had enough. That is wild. That is absolutely wild.
Yes, I think it's quite heartening, I think, that he's there. And yes, good luck and good health to him for the rest of the season. And of course, when he inevitably stays on for the first 3 months of next season as well.
There is no one else. There's literally no one else. That was the thing when he was at Palace last. Like, we dragged him back in to see us through, and it's like, well, there's no one else. We don't know who else to give the job to. So they end up, it's just unbelievable. I love Roy Hodgson. I do hope that he's doing the right thing. I just, yeah.
Well, yes. And talking of doing the right thing, another bit of interesting news fell in our laps today. news or just interesting statistics? Jan, the FSA have been doing good work again. They've been going out and canvassing match-going supporters about VAR and what they think about it. And what are the headline figures you've seen from this survey?
There's three that jump out at me from this post by somebody else, but I'll take what they've written anyway. So they asked, there's three questions here. Does VAR make football more enjoyable? 97% disagreed. Do you support the use of VAR? 76% disagreed. Are decisions reached in a reasonable time? 3% said yes. That's three. I would say three and then put in brackets, actually spell it out.
Yeah.
Three. Yeah, it's fairly damning. I mean, it doesn't surprise me reading that, but then again, I would answer those questions in exactly the same way as, you know, some of the 8,000 people that the FSA surveyed would. So I'm in complete agreement, but was it a loaded set of questions, Graham?
Well, I think there is certainly a feeling that amongst the good people at the FSA, I think there is a feeling that, that VAR is not good for the game. And I think the questions were slightly loaded into helping people give a more negative view of VAR or allowing people to express their negative views of VAR, which I think is also very helpful. The bigger problems with VAR, as far as fans are concerned, is that VAR is fine if you're watching at home on your TV, where little breaks in play allow you to go for a wee or make a cup of tea. In the ground, VAR is just so bloody annoying because you cannot celebrate. I was at the Emirates last week, there for the Women's Champions League quarterfinal. Don't normally have VAR in women's football. We do for the Champions League. So instantly, goals go in and you're thinking, can we celebrate? Can we celebrate? It's yeah, you get up and you celebrate, but there is still that little bit in the back of your head. And I think that is amplified so much more when you're in the ground rather than when you're at home watching it on telly. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all that when the FSA conducts a survey amongst match-going fans, that this is what they feel. They feel that it has a negative impact on the game. Terry, did those numbers surprise you at all?
Not from an FSA survey, no, because I would expect that the sample they have will be skewing towards match-going fans, and is also asking them about their opinions on television as well, on the televised version of it, yeah, or watching VAR on television as well. It shouldn't be at all surprising that match-going fans are antagonistic towards VAR, particularly those who are willing to answer surveys from the FSA as well. And I think that does need to be borne in mind. But the results are so decisive that even if you were to take a substantial amount of points away to weight against the fact that maybe your sample is biased, inherently biased, then they're still pretty decisive.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no close calls whatsoever in that survey. So even if that was a little bit weighted, then it's only going to be by a certain amount. It's interesting that the Premier League, the BBC went to reported this, and they went to the Premier League and asked for their response. And they said, we recognise the importance of minimising the impact of VAR on the supporter experience, which we kind of already knew. And as part of ongoing dialogue with supporters, Premier League research indicates fans are largely in favour of keeping VAR, but improving the way it is used. Now, I would suggest that they are talking to a different subset of football fans, and possibly including the match-going fans, but possibly including people who watch football on the television or online, and indeed not necessarily live match-going fans, people who might actually experience football, say, via text or social channels, maybe watching highlights. So I would suggest the Premier League probably will be looking at all the various different cohorts of people who watch football based on how they watch them, in addition to the usual sort of like traditional demographic breakdowns as well as like age and gender and stuff like that. So it's interesting that they say that, and it might well be true, because it might well be that online fans, for example, shall we call them online fans,
yeah,
see football perhaps differently to match-going fans. And that suggests that there might be a tension there, which, again, that is not something that we don't know. I think we're probably aware that there is a tension between, real fans and plastic fans. I mean, it's a tension that goes back from before the internet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Before online fandom. it's just that we don't call online fans plastic fans, but I'm sure there are a lot of people who probably do.
I'm sure they do. So, Jan, what this really shows, especially with the Premier League coming up with their own figures, of course they've got their own figures, haven't they? But their questions are going to be equally as loaded, if not more loaded, than the FSA's ones were. So what that says to me, and I think that's what Terry says there as well, is the fact that there is a rift there. It may not be a visible one at the moment, but there is one growing between fans that are, by and large, sofa-based and fans that are terrace-based.
Absolutely. I mean, the first game I ever saw with VAR, and if you remember, Greg, I was at the Olympic Stadium in Berlin, and there was a VAR decision in the Bundesliga, and no one knew inside of this giant stadium what the hell was going on, apart from the referee and maybe whoever he was speaking to. And I had to, listener, text Graham and ask him to tell me what was happening, because he knew, because he was watching the telly, which I think tells you all you need to know about why VAR exists. Because it really is only there for the fans watching it on television. And the product is now television, and the money is now in the television. So that's why it exists, and that's why it will never go away, because it's part of the product. And it's a real shame. Bear in mind as well that those fans that go there and pay through the nose are paying to be part of the product, because they're part of the spectacle as well. But it seems that doesn't really matter what they think. And that's a real shame, because it's fundamentally changed the game. And I think for the worse.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. But I think I don't sure that ship has entirely sailed, you know, because football clubs still continue to spend a great deal of money on expanding the capacity of their stadium, because the amount of money that they make in gate receipts is extraordinary. They go to great lengths. I mean, Jim Ratcliffe goes to extraordinary lengths to try and get the public to pay for his stadium, because he won't spend any of his non-taxpaying arse on it himself. So there is tremendous value still in the match-going public, and they are an extremely important constituency. But and the reason why I point out that very, very obvious thing is that it does put the Premier League in an interesting position, because it's if you are reaching the point where you're alienating your match-going public, then you are threatening a significant revenue for your member clubs, while at the same time recognising that football as a television spectacle is possibly, in a lot of people's minds, enhanced by VAR because of the additional drama, because of its defiance of the smell of the game. It provides an alternative smell of the game. And at some point, to be serious, the Premier League have to make a decision, really. It's like, what are we, events organisers? Do we sell tickets and put on matches and competitions and sell tickets? How much of what we do is that, and how much of what we do is create content for TV and for streaming to be consumed away from the stadium? And what's the balance here? I feel VAR tips the balance against the match-going public. And I think that's a mistake in the long term. Or that is to say, I think it's something that could be proved to be a mistake. As you say, it's not cheap. And I know that in a lot of cases, there are clubs that have season ticket holders, or people queuing for season tickets, waiting lists for season tickets and stuff. But most other clubs don't have that. You could get to a point where if it alienates supporters to a point where they decide that it's not worth renewing their season ticket and they'll buy on a match-by-match basis, and we start to see empty seats in, say, some of the mid-table clubs. And if they implement VAR in the Championship, I think that could get even worse, because they're really, you do have to be quite loyal and I think quite dedicated, I think, to persistently go along to a Championship game, because it's not the same spectacle. I think they need to be careful about, you know, where is the money coming from, and have they got that balance right? I mean, you certainly would be naive to say, oh, well, it should all be about the match day experience. It shouldn't be about telly at all. But in equally, it would be naive to say that match-going spectators are just simply that. They're part of a studio audience, when that isn't the case, because they're bringing a huge amount of money into their football club, millions and millions of pounds. So not to be discounted. I feel that they haven't got the balance right, the Premier League. And I think that that's why, one of the many reasons why VAR is, generally speaking, a terrible idea. And I think the Premier League, I think they will be looking very closely at this survey, despite what they might say publicly.
I mean, they'd be mad not to, wouldn't they? You can argue about selection bias and things like that, but it's the numbers are damning, even if you were to knock a few points off, Terry, as you said. I don't think there's much risk certainly in the short to medium term, of us seeing empty seats because of the demand that you talked about, Terry. There are queues a mile long to get season tickets for a lot of Premier League clubs. And it's not like we are, for example, in Germany. No one's going to put a mask on, jump across the terraces and unplug a VAR monitor in Britain. It's just not going to happen.
Sadly. It's not.
It is sad, but it's not in our character. And I don't think we'll see tennis ball protests or anything like that in the UK. Or if you do, you'll see it'll be minor stuff. The only time that protest becomes really manifest is when the club ownership is causing problems for the fans, that we saw with Manchester United. And of course, when they talked about completely changing the way football was played in terms of how it was organised, with the Super League. And other than that, it's kind of pockets of stuff. And I don't think we'll see that in the UK. And I think the kind of Premier League kind of know that they're not going to see any huge a swell of discontent with VAR, because it's sadly not in the British character.
No. You've raised an interesting point there, because if a fan set as motivated as the Bundesliga fans can't get rid of VAR, then there's no way the fans in the Premier League are going to do it. Yes, they were motivated when the Super League came on, but that's really because there was a lot of pressure from Sky, and Sky were allowing Gary Neville, amongst others, to come out against it. You're not getting broadcasters coming out against VAR at all. And so there isn't that constant media push to get rid of VAR like there was with the Super League. So I can't see any fan-based movement at the moment coming anywhere near touching VAR at the moment. If you can't do it in Germany, where they are motivated and they can coordinate themselves, then I can't see it happening over here.
Ultimately, I think you're right, depressingly. I wasn't necessarily thinking in terms of whether or not fans might protest. I was just thinking that, well, there might be a downturn in ticket sales in the longer term. I mean, again, not with the really, really top club. But I mean, in the longer term, we're talking about a sort of gradual alienation of a fan base if they feel that they are being ignored, or if they feel that, they're part of a set, in which case of a TV set, in which case, historically, if you want to go into a studio and be part of a TV set, you don't pay for those tickets.
Yes, indeed. Yes, the classic way of protesting if you're British, just don't turn up.
Yeah. It's a very effective way of protesting, actually, economic protest.
It is.
And it's non-confrontational, and it means you're not going to get your head beaten out by a policeman.
Well, it's Easter weekend, and there's loads of football to watch if you like watching the EFL, because there are two rounds of fixtures, one round on Friday and one round on Easter Monday, and all entirely without VAR. On Friday, we've got Middlesbrough versus Millwall at lunchtime. That one's going to be a cracker, isn't it? A big fight for the automatic promotion places.
Absolutely. I mean, that's going to be a proper blood and thunder, I would suggest. Millwall, bit of a surprise package this season, I think it's fair to say. But they've gone great guns, though. They and Borough dropped a few points recently, but they're both very much in it. It's a race for second place that Borough have got the slight lead on. But I think that's genuinely going to be a great game.
And a chance to put some distance between themselves and Nigel Farage's Ipswich Town. just to lay down a marker there.
Absolutely, an opportunity to stick it to Nigel Farage and his Ipswich side. that was a thing that happened last week as well.
Jan, do you want to add anything about that thing that happened last week?
Well, it's going to be a thing that's going to happen in a couple of weeks, because sadly, one of Sunderland's director, Juan Santori, who is a right-wing politician, I won't go as far to libel him, but he is a right-wing politician in Uruguay, has invited Nigel Farage to the Stadium of Light, having both met each other at Davos earlier in the year. So that has provoked a split right down the middle of the Sunderland fan base, which is ugly. A bit like Mr. Farage's politics.
Sunderland, of course, being the first constituency to declare in the Brexit referendum, wasn't it?
Well, because Sunderland can be quite a volatile place like that, you do get the far right going there, and they go there because they're drawn and they want to provoke that. When Sunderland played Celtic many years ago in a pre-season friendly, Tommy Robinson was at that event, and now Farage is going there to further stoke divisions, and he can stay away, as far as I'm concerned. It's awful, and I'm ashamed, genuinely ashamed, that he's been invited to a club that's got a long history and tradition with the working classes, with the Durham Miners, and we've stood against fascism because of that, and we're inviting one in to the ground, and it's disgusting.
There you go, listeners.
Well said.
Well said. There's a load of FA Cup matches on Easter Saturday, including City versus Liverpool, Chelsea at home to Port Vale, and Arsenal away to Southampton. The fourth tie is on Easter Sunday. That is West Ham versus Leeds. There's also Women's FA Cup as well over the weekend. And if you want to see what we picked to put in our box set this weekend, then get along to sofpodcast.com. Click on the link for the weekend box set and subscribe to our Substack, and it will be in your inbox on Friday. Well, actually, it'll be in your inbox on Thursday this week because it's Easter. So, and the first game in there is Friday lunchtime. Okay, Jan, you got that?
Yes, understood.
Yeah, understood.
Oh, I don't know why you're singling me out.
Good. I'm just saying.
I think you do.
Just saying. But that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFillon, it's goodbye.
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 Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football, or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us and review us. Do it now! That is all we have time for this week, because we've got to go off and write out our previews.
Yeah. Oh, and England versus Japan. Don't forget that.
Oh, that's... and England versus Japan. Is that tonight?
That's...
Is it really? I thought it was tomorrow night.
No, it's tonight.
Oh, well, great.
It's international friendly. It doesn't matter. It doesn't count.
I could have sworn it was tonight. He's going to bug me now. It doesn't matter. You can say goodbye if you want to.
So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFillon, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah, it's tomorrow.